Hello, hello, welcome everybody. Good morning, or good afternoon, wherever your time zone is online. Welcome to class, welcome to Paradox. It's good to see you all, and a hello to everybody. Again, if you're watching online, be sure to submit your questions on the YouTube page, and we'll try to get to them. Some news, we got Dr. Ross with us today, which is amazing, and even more amazing, we have him for the next 10 Sundays, which is awesome. And on June 16th, he's going to be preaching at the pulpit in our church, and the subject is going to be Genesis. And that should, I believe, kick off a new series on Genesis in this class. So that's something really to look forward to. And if you have time, visit and watch the sermon. It's going to be great. We're all looking forward to that. Again, we'll take questions after the lesson today. If you're online, submit them, and we look forward to answering them. And then I think that's it. So we'll get started. Let me say a quick prayer, and then Dr. Ross will be up here. Lord Jesus, King of the universe, thank you so much for this amazing, amazing class we have with this amazing man, Dr. Hugh Ross, to teach us. Lord, please give us of your spirit to love better, to love each other, and love you, God. Help us to follow your commands and follow your spirit as it compels us throughout each day. Lord, we thank you for your love and your eternal hope that we cling to. Help us to cling to it even more, God, in dire times. We love you, Jesus, and we pray this in your name. Amen. Please welcome Dr. Ross.
Good morning and good afternoon. We literally have people from all different time zones working with us, even at 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, yes, on June 16th, I will be giving the sermon messages in the church, and I'll be giving two different messages. The first one's going to be on just how big God is and how that should impact our prayer life. And the second one is going to be about the lessons, the spiritual lessons that animals can teach us. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in today's message as we look at how do we respond to the claims of naturalistic evolution. And so, as I mentioned in the book, Rescuing Inerrancy, one of the primary reasons why modern-day theologians are abandoning the doctrine that the Bible is the inspired, inerrant Word of God and everything that it teaches is they feel that Darwin and naturalistic evolutionists are right, and therefore we have to reinterpret the Bible in a way that accommodates the origin and history of life coming about through natural processes that God sets up in advance. But it's more than that, as we're going to demonstrate. It's not strictly naturalistic. God does intervene in unmistakable ways. So, and you've probably seen this if you've ever taken any high school biology. This is the model for the history of life. That life begins with the origin of what they call the last universal common ancestor, which is a very tiny microbe, like a tenth of a micron across, having only a few hundred gene products in it, and how all life evolves from that single, incredibly tiny and simple microorganism into all the species we have today, and how through natural processes we see that life becomes more diverse, more complex, and bigger as time goes on. And the story is that life becomes gradually and progressively more complex through natural processes, through the mechanism of common descent, which means that all species descend from lower, more primitive species that existed in the past. And that these changes, these advances are brought about through four mechanisms: natural selection, mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics. Mutations being responsible for the biggest changes, then natural selection, then gene exchange and epigenetics. As I mentioned, as we closed last Sunday, people who believe in naturalistic evolutionists do not like the label Darwinist, because Darwin basically was aware of only one of these mechanisms, natural selection. Neither do they like the term neo-Darwinism, the new Darwinism, because the new Darwinism is a recognition that life evolves through natural selection and mutations. They say, no, it's more complex than that. It's natural selection, mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics. And most people are familiar what natural selection is all about, and mutations, changes in our genes. What they're less familiar with is gene exchange and epigenetics. And gene exchange is something we see with the smaller, more primitive life forms. So for example, we notice that some bacterial species are capable of transmitting some of their genes, not all of their genes, but some of their genes into a different microbial species. And so this is one way of generating changes over time. Epigenetics is something that happens with bigger, more complex species, like us human beings, which means that for the more advanced species, species that the Bible declares as being soulish, nephesh animals, that God has endowed with intellect, emotions, and will, the behavior of these creatures actually is something that can be passed on to a limited extent to future generations. So, and this is actually in the Bible, that the righteousness of the parents can benefit the children to the third and fourth generation. That's the positive. The negative is that the sins of the parents can be passed on to the children to the second, third, and fourth generation. So the way we parents behave actually can impact the genes that are being passed on by our children to their grandchildren. So behavior is important. And so, and we see this in the human species. We also see it in other animal species that fall into that category of being endowed with emotions, intellect, and will. We don't see it in the lower life forms, nor do we see gene exchange in the higher life forms. And so this is important because often when you read the evolutionary literature, they make it sound like gene exchange applies to all species of life. It doesn't. Or that epigenetics applies to all species of life. It doesn't. Mechanisms that you'll now see in the scientific literature. And as I mentioned at the very end of last week, there has been a diligent search to see if there's a fifth or a sixth mechanism that may apply in generating changes. They've yet to find such a mechanism, but what they have done in their research is basically concluded. If these four mechanisms are complemented by other mechanisms, these other mechanisms contribute much less than 0.5% to the changes that we see going on over the past 3.8 billion years. Now, with these four mechanisms, what you notice is even the most dramatic of the mechanisms, changes in our genes and mutations, still produce relatively small changes. Mutations can produce big changes. When they produce big changes, it kills the individual. So those genes don't get passed on to the next generation. The mutations have to be relatively tiny in order for survival to take place to the next generation. So we're talking small changes brought about by natural selection, mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics. And therefore, you would predict the following if you're using a naturalistic model, that these evolutionary mechanisms will yield a proliferation of additional species. And incidentally, you'll see in the scientific literature people responding very strongly to people like us who believe that there's supernatural intervention on the hand of the Creator, and they say, don't you understand? We actually see speciation going on in real time. And they're correct. We do see some limited speciation going on in real time, and their claim is if we see speciation going on in real time, we can extrapolate that to all the higher levels of categories of creatures, of plants, and animals. Now, the evidence I see cited in the scientific literature, one of the more famous examples is they look at the islands of Galapagos, they look at the islands off the coast of British Columbia, and the case of what we see after the coast of British Columbia is you have all these daisies. That's a polite term. Dandelions are a daisy, and so often we think of daisies as weeds. But the daisy family produces these flowers that eventually produce a parachute. And so there's this little fluffy parachute with a seed attached to it. And if you ever watch dandelions, that's what happens when they mature. They produce all these parachutes that the wind carries into different places, and that's how daisies distribute their seeds. They basically count on the wind to carry the seeds. Another example of seeds being carried is, think of raspberries and blueberries and blackberries. What happens? Animals eat them, and they wander around, and they defecate the seeds, and that's how the seeds get distributed. So there's various ways for the seeds to be distributed. However, this actually affects the evolution of the daisies. So for example, what they discovered off the coast of British Columbia is that when you've got daisies growing on small islands where there's a significant distance to the next island, what will happen over time is that the daisies will microevolutionary evolve where they produce small parachutes. Because if they produce big parachutes, what's going to happen? The seeds will blow it over the water and nothing will happen. They will die. And so they will evolve to make small parachutes so that they don't get distributed away from the island. And what they notice is on the really big islands is that the seeds produce big parachutes, because that way they can be distributed over the entirety of the island. Then you go to the mainland where you don't have any water to worry about, and that's where you see the biggest parachutes of all. And so they say, yeah, over the course of 40 years, we can see that seeds that go from a small island over to a big island, after several generations, the parachutes get bigger. And then the seeds that come from a big island go to a smaller island. Once they get in a smaller island, over many generations, the parachutes get smaller. And this is another example of what Charles Darwin observed when he was in the Galapagos Islands, that depending on the size of the islands, he noticed microevolutionary changes in the finches. And so he noticed that the beaks of the finches would get longer or shorter or wider as a result of the environmental pressures that were affecting the food supply of the finches. And so where a bigger beak would allow it to gather more food, over time the beak would get bigger. Now, the fallacy in all of that in terms of extrapolation is that Charles Darwin was on the Galapagos Islands for just 3 years. And what he saw was some finches, the beaks were getting bigger, others they were getting smaller, some were getting wider, but he was only there for 3 years. Evolutionary biologists have now been studying these finches for 170 years. And what have they been observing? They've been observing that the different species of finches, rather than the beaks getting bigger and bigger and bigger, they get bigger, then they transition and become smaller. And they become wider and they become narrower. So instead of seeing a linear progression that you can extrapolate to get a really big change in the finch, what they're seeing instead is a sinusoidal oscillation. And the sinusoidal oscillation is driven by changes in the environment. And what they saw on the islands off the coast of British Columbia with daisies was the same thing. You observe long enough, and we notice is that the changes are sinusoidal, tiny changes going up and down, but nothing that you can extrapolate over a long period of time. But this is the naturalistic evolutionary model, that you get environmental stress that will cause, or environmental advantages that will cause microevolutionary changes in a species, and you get a new species. Now, I say new species because in the scientific literature, you'll find between 16 and 25 different definitions of a species. I'm an astrophysicist. When we come up with definitions, it means one thing and only one thing. But biology is complicated. It's really hard to come up with a definition. So for example, there's a claim in the scientific literature that they observed over a period of just 20 years one bird species becoming two distinct bird species. But it was all based on how they define a speciation event. What happened was there was a bird species on one side of a mountain range. And some of the individuals in that species flew over the mountain range to the other side. And then they began to have several generations over there. And it was very rare for them ever to meet. But when they did meet, what they noticed after about 10 generations, the birds on one side of the mountain range would refuse to mate with the birds on the other side of the mountain range. And they said, well, this is a speciation event. One definition of a species, if they don't mate with one another, they're two distinct species. Now, again, the fallacy in all that is you actually force the two groups of birds to spend significant time with one another. If you wait long enough, they will begin to mate with one another. But yeah, if you geographically separate them, because of the way they behave, they won't. Now, the classic claim of a speciation event for mammals, and there was about 8,000 mammals when God created Adam and Eve. There's about 4,000 today, so half of them have gone extinct. And they said, well, we do see a new species of mammals arise. And what has happened is here in North America, we had one species of bison, and now we got two species. We got the plains bison, and we got the wood bison. And but that's now been taken out of the scientific literature, because what they realized is, well, what happened was the Canadians took all the bison and moved them up to northern Alberta and the Northwest Territories, where it's really cold. And because of how cold it is, what they notice is over time, that herd of bison developed a larger body size. Whereas the plains bison that were being gathered in places like Kansas, where it's warm, especially in the summertime, they noticed that the bison there developed smaller body sizes. And so they said, hey, well, this is a speciation event. We have one species, and now we got two, one with small body sizes, one with large body sizes. But when they brought the big buffalo together with the small buffalo, they realized they were quite willing to mate with one another. And so they said, we were mistaken. This is not a speciation event. It's simply driven by the fact that it's really cold in the Northwest Territories and quite warm in Kansas. And so we've yet to observe one mammal species coming into existence under real-time observations. Significant because we've seen over half of the mammal species go extinct during the human era, and the number that have replaced the ones that have gone extinct stands at zero. Okay. But this is the model, that you get this proliferation of species. If you wait long enough, and if you wait a really long time, the proliferation of species eventually will give you a new genus. A genus being the larger category of life forms. And if you wait much longer, the new genera will produce new families. And if you wait even longer, the new families will produce new orders, new classes, and last of all, you're gonna get the phyla showing up. And again, just taking it back to your high school biology class, where they give you this category system where you got the kingdom. And kingdom is like, well, that would be the animals, the plants, and then the microbes. And then you get at the level of the phyla, which is the different categories, for example, of plants and animals. And so the phyla basically refers to the body plans of the plants and the animals, the fundamental body plans. And so for animals, that's the very top category of classification. And then the subcategory underneath that would be the different classes. And then you got the different orders. And then you got the different families, genera, and last of all, the species. And so we human beings belong to the chordate phylum. That's a phylum that has a basic body plan of a long neural cord, which would be that long neural cord that runs down your backbone and surrounded by the vertebrae. That, of course, includes all the vertebrates, but it also includes a whole lot of species of life that don't have vertebrates, but they do have that long neural cord that controls the musculature of the creature. And so that's a basic body plan. And mathematically, there's only a little less than 200 basic body plans that are possible. And what's interesting, when we look at the life on planet Earth, it literally comes very close to the theoretical maximum number of body plans. So we really do see virtually every possible body plan that mathematics would allow. But here's a challenge to the naturalistic model. The fossil record reveals the opposite of what naturalistic evolutionary models predict. And the one that first discovered this was James Valentine back in the 1980s when he was studying the Cambrian explosion. And then other researchers discovered the same thing's true at the Avalon explosion. In fact, it's true at every mass speciation event, that instead of seeing a proliferation of species at the beginning of the speciation event, we first see the proliferation of phyla. And last of all, we see the proliferation of species. The new phyla appear first, not last. Moreover, they appear simultaneously and suddenly. So for example, you look at the Cambrian explosion. To put this in context, today on planet Earth, we see 30 phyla amongst all the animals on the face of the Earth, 30 basic body plans. The Cambrian explosion, 538 million years ago, we see the sudden appearance of a minimum of 50 phyla. It may be as many as 100, but at least 50. So we got, you know, 20 more than we have on the face of the Earth today show up at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion. Moreover, when I was going to school, what they taught us is, yes, we have all these phyla showing up in the Cambrian era, but they show up sequentially. The simplest phyla show up first, the most complex phyla shows up 50 million years later at the end of the Cambrian event. That claim is out of date, and I'm rather surprised that when I debate evolutionary biologists, some of them still tell that story, that during the Cambrian era, we don't see all the phyla showing up at once, we see a progression from the simplest to the most complex. But the latest scientific literature tells us they all show up at the beginning. They show up together. They show up simultaneously. They show up suddenly. And so you even have Richard Dawkins making the point about the Avalon explosion and the Cambrian explosion. These new phyla come out of nowhere with zero evolutionary history. The evolutionary model would predict that you need a significant passage of slow progression over time. We don't see that. These phyla show up out of nowhere. So, for example, the Avalon event 575 million years ago, you go from a realm with only microbes or microbial animals and plants, and then suddenly you got animals 2 meters across. And so you go from just microbial stuff to actually big animal, and it happens suddenly, and the phyla show up again, all at once and suddenly. They show up as soon as the physical and chemical conditions permit their existence. Now, at the Avalon explosion, this is the first time you see big animals on the face of the Earth. But the Avalon event 575 million years ago consists of animals that don't have external organs. They don't have a brain, they don't have a stomach, they don't have a digestive tract, they don't have a circulatory system. They're filter feeders. Think of sponges, for example, big animals, jellyfish, but they're lacking skeletons, circulatory tracts, and digestive tracts. But they show up immediately when the oxygen jumps from 2% up to 8%. The significance of that is it's impossible for these animals to exist unless there's 8% oxygen in the atmosphere. Now, the Cambrian animals, these are animals that do have circulatory systems, digestive tracts, skeletons. They have ears, they have eyes, they've got a heart, they've got a brain. So they've got both internal and external organs. But we notice the same thing, is that they show up the moment that oxygen jumps from 8% up to 10%. So this is the oxygenation history that we see the entire past 4.5 billion years. And what you see for the first 2.3 billion years is the oxygen in the atmosphere is less than 0.1%. It exists, but exists at a very low level. And then you get what's called the first great oxygenation event, where for a few hundred million years, it jumps up to 1 or 2% oxygen, but then jumps back below 1% oxygen. And then you notice at about 700 million years ago, 750 million years ago, you get a slow rise from 1% up to 2%. And then at 578 million years ago, it get a sudden jump from 2% to 8%. When it hits 8%, you got the Cambrian Avalon explosion. So you see these Avalon animals the moment that oxygen permits their existence. There is no time delay. And then there's a geological event that drives those animals to extinction. And then all that same geological event pushes the oxygen content up from 8% to 10%. The moment it hits 10%, you get the Cambrian explosion, 538 million years ago, and all the phyla of the Cambrian show up at the beginning of the Cambrian, not in the middle, not at the end, but at the beginning. Now, the reason why this didn't show up in the scientific literature until recently is that the first Cambrian creatures, fossils, were discovered in the Canadian Rockies, and that was at the middle of the Cambrian event. And so they said, oh, these are creatures that show up in the middle. The more primitive ones are at the beginning. The more advanced ones are at the end. And they were predicting we're going to find the chordates at the end. The shock was they come up with some sites in South China. And the South Chinese fossil beds are at the beginning of the Cambrian, not in the middle of the Cambrian like you see in Canada. And what did they see at the beginning? They saw all the fossils that you see in the middle were also there at the beginning, and they actually saw fish showing up at the beginning of the Cambrian event, which means not only do you have chordates at the beginning of the Cambrian, you even have vertebrates at the beginning of the Cambrian. And every eye design that we have on the planet today was fully present at the Cambrian explosion. I wrote an article on that at reasons.org that you can see. Okay, and then when the oxygen jumps up to 20%, this is when you get birds, this is when you get mammals that are able to move around a lot. But the other thing you notice is what we're seeing is creatures that are able to withstand the toxicity of oxygen. You know, the wonderful thing about your human body, it's able to have you live for 70, 80, 90 years in spite of the fact you're breathing in 21% oxygen. Oxygen is incredibly corrosive. If you don't believe me, leave your tools outside and see what happens to them after a few weeks of being left on a lawn where the sprinklers come on. Okay, they'll get thick rust. Same thing happens to your body, but we creatures, we mammals and birds, we are designed in such a way to deal with the highly toxic nature of oxygen. And we humans are at the top of the peak. We not only are able to survive in a high oxygen environment, we're able to survive for 60, 70, 80, 90 years and be active during that time. Okay, I want to spend the rest of the time talking about whales. You say, why whales? Because what I've noticed is that even in junior high, whales are introduced to public school students as the primary proof that evolution is strictly naturalistic. Look what happened to the whales, that explains what happens all the way across. It's taught in high school, it's taught in college, it's taught in graduate school. And a few years ago, I participated in a conference of theistic evolutionists from around the world. These were all Christians, but they believed that naturalistic evolution explained the entire history of life. They did believe that God set things up so that evolution would do its thing, but was able to do its thing without God intervening in any miraculous way. And I remember one evolutionary biologist who had a PhD in the, quote, evolution of whales. She spoke for a whole hour and brought out this litany of creatures. I'm just going to show you some of the creatures that she brought out. Okay, this is Indohyus. It is an animal about the size of a raccoon. The fossil evidence puts it back at about 55 million years ago. And they say this is the ancestor to all the whales on planet Earth today. Now, they came to this conclusion because they noticed is that this creature has really heavy bones. And so they said this is a creature, because of its heavy bones, would be able to go from the land into the water and be able to get prey. Because with those heavy bones, it could actually submerge to a significant depth, catch prey, and come back up to the surface. You can't do that if you've got light bones. If you've got light bones, you basically pop up to the surface. And so you need the heavy bones and able to be able to submerge and go down and get that food. So they're saying, well, that's the thing with whales. They got heavy enough bones that the water doesn't force their body to float up. And so maybe I'm evolved from an Indo-Hyas, because, I always entertain kids in our neighborhood by going into a pool and walking on the bottom of the pool. My secret is I only take half a breath. If I take half a breath, I sink and go to the bottom. But I actually scared some people on one of the vacations we took years ago, because we all got on top of a high rock and we jumped into the Colorado River. And everybody jumped into the Colorado River and popped up within a few seconds. It took me 45 seconds to come back up to the top of the water. And they were about to call a rescue party to see if they could recover my body. But I did make it back up. And I was the only one that touched bottom. And that's, a few of us are like that. We're quote the sinkers. But this creature was a sinker, Indo-Hyas. That's 55 million years ago. And then you wait a few million years and you get this creature, a Pachycetus. And this is considered the ancestor. By the way, hippos are also considered to be an ancestor of Indo-Hyas. Because one of the things about a hippo is it's got such heavy bones that in spite of its huge body mass, it's able to sink into the water. And this is what makes hippos so dangerous, because during the daytime, they go into the water to cool off, and all that's sticking above the water are their nostrils, and maybe the tips of their ears, the rest of their body is below, and it's because of their heavy bones that they're able to do that. So the claim is that both hippos and all the whales are descended naturalistically from Indo-Hyas, and then we come up with Pachycetus at 50 million years ago. And instead of being like, a foot and a half long or half a meter long, this creature was 1 to 2 meters long, so it got bigger. So over 5 million years, and the story is it got bigger. Still amphibious, mainly walking on the land, but because of its heavy bones, it was able to go into the water. It was freshwater only and able to get prey. And then we also see this creature at 47 million years ago, also about 1 to 2 meters long, but they notice it was drinking fresh water only, not able to drink salt water, and basically stuck close to the shore, but had good eyes and could see stuff in the water and would jump into the water and basically grab prey. You notice it's got big, flat feet, which means it can't propel itself very easily in the water, so they believe that it hunted by ambushing. It would basically use its heavy bones to drop into the water, hold its breath, and basically wait in ambush for something to swim by. And then we come up about 45 million years ago. This is Cuchicetus. This is Ambulocetus. Then Cuchicetus, cetus meaning whale. And this is 45 million years ago. But this creature is quite small. We're talking half a meter to a meter long, including the length of the tail. So it's kind of like an otter, or like a sea otter. That's 45 million years ago. And then we get to something big, Rhodhocetus, 45 million years ago. And this creature is 2 to 3 meters long. But what you notice is they still have four limbs that are able to enable it to move on land. But also, you notice now it's got limbs that make it easier for it to be able to go at relatively high speed in the water. And then we come to Durodon at 39 million years ago. Now it's 5 meters long. So now we're seeing it get longer. But what you notice here, these are all predators. They're basically using big jaws to capture large prey. We don't see any baleen whales at any time during this early history. This is Squalodon at 29 million years ago, 5 meters long, so we're talking 16, 17 feet long. But also, it's got a big jawed mouth that goes after large prey. The first baleen whale is this one at 25 million years ago, Horopida. And what it does here is it has this huge mouth, drinks in a lot of water, and in that water will be small sea creatures, and it uses its baleen, which is basically a tiny net that allows the water to go through, but not the animals, and it eats the animals. So these are the first baleen whales, and here we're talking creatures that are no longer just 15 feet long, they're 20 to 25 feet long. And so the story is this. We see in the fossil record this progression of animals that become more and more like the whales we see today. The body sizes are getting bigger, and we notice the jaw structure is becoming less like T-Rex and more like this thin little jaw with teeth in it that's ideal for swimming in water and capturing prey in the water. And the claim is all the whales on the face of the earth indeed evolved from this land creature that was the size of a raccoon. And so today, we have sperm whales, which are, this is the largest of the whales that prey on big creatures. And so sperm whales basically go after giant squid that are as much as 50 feet long. But what you also notice is that it's, although it's got this huge head, its jaw structure is basically long and thin with teeth in it. So again, it's designed to be able to swim in water efficiently, but be able to grab large prey. And so we have a few species of these. Orcas are in this category. Sperm whales are in this category. The beluga whales. But there's just a handful of whale species that have these big jaws with teeth in it for grabbing fish and larger animals. Most of the whales we have on the planet today are baleen whales, like this blue whale, where they have this structure that basically filters out everything, allows the water to go through, but not all the little tiny animals. So here's this creature, 100 feet long, weighs 200 tons, and feeds on tiny krill, animals that are just a fraction of a centimeter across, but it goes into places of the world where there's lots of these krill, and basically opens his mouth, gobbles up a bunch of them, spits out the water, and then consumes a few thousand little tiny creatures that are in that area. Now, at this conference, this evolutionary biologist spoke for an hour on how this is the best proof we have that, you know, this natural selection, mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics explains the entire history of life without the need to God to supernaturally intervene, other than the fact he sets up all of physics and chemistry at the beginning. Now, I was sitting at a table with eight theologians, and there was a couple of evolutionary biologists there, and the theologian said, "Well, Hugh, we know you're the founder of Reasons to Believe. What do you think of this lecture you heard?" And my response was, "Well, I think they picked on the wrong creature to claim that this is evidence for evolution." They said, "What do you mean?" I says, "Well, whales are really big. And the bigger the creature, the more challenging it is for it to change through natural selection and mutations, gene exchange, and epigenetics." And I says, "Also, they don't have very many progeny for adult. I mean, with whales, basically, they give birth to one baby at a time. And they're pregnant for a couple of years. So you don't get a lot of progeny from an individual whale. And the fewer progeny you have per individual, the slower the possibility of getting any change." And it says also they got very complex biochemistry. The more complex the biochemistry, the more challenging it is to make evolutionary changes. And it says also the biggest problem is populations. It says it's easy for bacteria to evolve significantly because there's quadrillions of them. The more individuals you have, the greater the probability you're going to get some change that will be able to pass on to the next generation. But so when you look at the whales, there's not a whole lot of them. The populations of each species of whales is quite small. And then you've got a long generation time. I mean, if you're a bacterium, a bacterium can be born, 20 minutes later, they're able to reproduce. A whale is born, and it's years later before they can reproduce. So the bigger the animal, the less the population, the fewer the progeny, the more complex the biochemistry, the lower the probability of any evolutionary change. And my response to the theologians was, you know, this is the worst animal to pick as an example of biological evolution by natural means. It's at the bottom of the heap in terms of every criteria that would explain how rapidly it could evolve. And so that also applies to us human beings. You know, our population is much bigger than the whales, but it's still only a few billion. We don't have quadrillions of human beings. We have a big body size. We don't have a lot of progeny per adult. I mean, a couple gets together, they might have, what, three children? It's very difficult to get any rapid evolutionary change if you have so few progeny per adult. And look at our generation time. What is it? It takes 25 years before any automobile company will allow you to rent a car. That's because it takes 25 years for the brain of a male to fully become mature. By the way, all of you females here, you actually get there in 24 years. So, but I noticed the car companies will not rent to you even if you're female and 24. They want you to be 25. But the fact that we take so long to go from being born to being able to reproduce, and what's happening today is the human population is being struck by the fact that the reproduction time is getting longer and longer with every generation. So if you go back 1,000 years, it was not uncommon for women to give birth to the first baby at age 15. Now it's challenging to find a woman that's giving birth to her first child at age 35. And that's because we have a technology factor. The greater the technology, the lower the probability for evolutionary advance, but also applies to non-human animals. The more capable they are of being able to use their environment for their advantage, the lower the probability they're going to evolve. What was interesting at this conference, I had these 8 theologians around the table asking me this question, what do you think of the lecture I just heard? And then they turned to the evolutionary biologist that was a theistic evolutionist and says, look, Hugh's an astrophysicist, you're an evolutionary biologist, what do you think of what Hugh just said? And he looked at the 8 theologians and said, Hugh's right. Whales are not going to be able to evolve at any degree. Now, they asked me the next question. Okay, if whales are not a good example of naturalistic evolution, how do you explain this fossil record? How do you explain this progression of all these creatures? How do you explain the whales getting bigger and bigger? And how do you explain the fact that you got whales beginning in freshwater environments only, and then they move into environments that are estuaries, where the water is a little saltier than it is with freshwater, and eventually they're able to go into even the saltiest waters in the face of the earth? How do you explain the fact that they start off in just a few water habitats, expand into all the freshwater habitats, and then into all the water habitats of the world? What's going on there? And my point was, well, another factor that's been overlooked in evolutionary biology is the crucial role that whales play in ensuring that our planet doesn't get too warm. And they said, well, how's that work? Whales breathe out carbon dioxide. Isn't that a greenhouse gas? And I said, well, there's a number of studies showing that, yes, whales breathe out carbon dioxide, which you would think would warm the planet, and they're big, so they breathe out a lot of carbon dioxide. But the property of all whales is that they defecate soluble iron at the surface. And it's that soluble iron that fertilizes the phytoplankton. And so for every ton of carbon dioxide that whales breathe out, 4 tons of carbon dioxide are consumed by what they defecate, because what they defecate actually enhances the phytoplankton population. They go up, they grow more efficiently, and as they do, because they're photosynthetic, their photosynthesis pulls carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Today, 70% of the carbon dioxide being pulled out of the atmosphere by life is being pulled out by phytoplankton. They contribute way more than all the plants on the continental land masses. And it's thanks to the whales that we have way more phytoplankton than we had in the past. But if God had created all the whale species, say, 55 million years ago, too much carbon dioxide would have been pulled out of the atmosphere. And so what God did is he increased the population size of the whales, the body size of the whales, and the spread of habitat space of the whales, so that step by step, more and more carbon dioxide was being pulled out of the atmosphere, because what else is going on? The sun is getting brighter and brighter. So as the sun gets brighter and brighter, it's necessary to pull progressively more and more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Whales play a crucial role in ensuring that the temperature in the surface of the Earth is optimal for life. And that's why the nations of the world today have said, we got to restore the whale populations. We got to bring them back to what they were 300 years ago. We're not there yet. We got quite a ways to go. But I'll just share this before we go to Q&A. Another reason why we need to bring the whale populations back is what you see in Psalm 104. There's a verse there that talks about how whales frolic with the ships. And whales are very intelligent animals. And they're very playful animals. And they especially like to play with us human beings. And a few years ago, I took my wife to Tadoussac, Quebec. And that's a place that's about 200 miles north and east of Quebec City. And it's famous for having the highest whale population in the world. And what's happening is in the estuary of the St. Lawrence River, where the St. Lawrence estuary is about 100 miles across, but there's a deep sea cliff at that point. And because of that deep sea cliff, plankton and krill are gathered up against the cliff face and pushed up to the surface, and the whales know that. Whales come from all over the world to feed there because they can very efficiently feed at that point. And hey, if you ever want a whale-watching adventure, we were in a Zodiac, small Zodiac, with a dozen people surrounded by hundreds of whales. Every hour, we saw 100 whales up close. And we actually saw them playing. So for example, we would see these humpback whales. And humpback whales have these huge fins. Most whales don't have big fins, but humpback whales have big fins. And they like to play with them. And so they'll roll over and stick one of its fins out of the water and basically wave. And we got to see that literally from a few feet away. And when they know there's humans around, they'll come and entertain the humans and do this waving thing. I've got photos showing that happening. Probably the thing that was a little bit scary is we had three whales that were together side by side, and we would see them off in the distance, and they would charge towards our Zodiac at high speed. So we saw these three big whales charging towards us. And the captain of the Zodiac said, don't worry, they're not going to flip us over. It just looks like they're going to flip us over. At the last minute, all three dove underneath our Zodiac, went over to the other side, swam away, and they came back and did it again and again and again. So they like to play, and they like to play with humans. And they're very fond of humans. I have a cousin in Vancouver Island, and he was out in a one-man rowboat, rowing away, and he said suddenly a 50-foot gray whale came right up beside his. He said, I thought he was going to just capsize me, But the whale very gently just moved over towards his rowboat and just stayed there by the rowboat. And then my cousin began to stroke the back of the whale and noticed that the whale seemed to enjoy that. So he did that for a few minutes. Then the gray whale dove and disappeared. And my cousin thought, well, that's going to be the end. No, a few minutes later, that mother gray whale came back with her calf and pushed the calf up so the calf could also be stroked. And so, I mean, it's something I'm going to be preaching about on the 16th, the second service. I'm going to be talking about how God designed birds and mammals to relate to us and serve and please us. And the only thing that prevents that is our sin. Take away the sin feature, you get to see how God designed them originally. Okay, let's go to the Q&A. But the more we learn about the book of nature, the more reasons we gain to trust the Bible and Jesus as Creator, Lord, and Savior. The evidence for creation is mounting, it's not dropping. Okay.
Thank you, Hugh. The way we're going to do this is if you have a question and you're in the live audience, come on back and we'll take turns between people here and people online. So our friend Tom Longo has a question, Hugh. He says, would you speak to us about the 10-dimensional universe?
Sure.
He says, is this purely a mathematical extrapolation? And how certain are we about how many dimensions there really are?
Well, that began at Caltech about 25 years ago. And there was a research group there, theoretical physicists, by the way, several of them who were followers of Jesus Christ. And they began to recognize that for life to be possible, quantum mechanics and gravity and general relativity, they've got to coexist. But to have them coexist, there simply isn't enough room within the dimensions of length, width, and height to have all the theoretical symmetries of general relativity and quantum mechanics simultaneously existing. So there's got to be more dimensions. So in answer to the question, we know there has to be more than just length, width, and height to the space dimensions of the universe. But it took about another decade before that team at Caltech, led by John Swartz, actually figured out how many dimensions do we need to have both quantum mechanics and general relativity so that life can exist in the universe. And after 10 years, they figured out, well, we know it has to be at least 8 dimensions of space and not more than 26 dimensions of space. And then the Caltech people said, well, you guys figure it out. Which one is it? 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, up to 26. It took another decade before they discovered the answer is 9. And so you need 3 big dimensions and 6 tiny dimensions. And the model is this. The universe begins with 9 dimensions of space that all rapidly expand from the cosmic creation event. And when the universe is 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, that's a 10 millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, 6 of those 9 dimensions stop expanding. And because they stop at that point, you can actually have particles of zero volume that have mass. Doesn't work if you only have 3 dimensions of space. And so as a means by which physicists could have their cosmic creation model consistent with their particle creation model. At 10 to the minus 43 seconds, 6 of those 9 dimensions of space stop expanding, and the other 3 continue to expand. And now we can integrate particle physics with our cosmic creation model. By the way, a lot of people think string theory is the answer. It's one of many theoretical physics models that would explain how you can have your particle creation model consistent with your cosmic creation model. But there are other models too. What they all have in common, you do need 6 extra tiny space dimensions. You say, well, how tiny are they? Well, think of a piece of paper, a rectangular piece of paper. If you roll it up very tightly, like a scroll, and make it so tight, it will appear to you to be a single line. So 2 dimensions actually appear to be one dimension. And so these six extra dimensions are like scrolls wrapped up very tightly around the three big dimensions of length, width, and height. And the cross-section of the scroll is 20 orders of magnitude, that is 10 billion trillion times smaller than the diameter of an electron, which probably explains why most of you haven't noticed those six extra dimensions. That's how tiny they are. But without those six extra dimensions, we wouldn't be here. Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, hi. A number of years ago, I taught a class here in Paradox class called Why I No Longer Believe in Evolution. And one of the strongest points that I've seen, and I want to see if you agree with this, is in my personal opinion, mankind has already done real-time experiments to prove that evolution is not true, in particular natural selection. And that's because we've been breeding dogs for 10,000 years. We've been breeding horses for probably 3,000-4,000 years. So that is a real-time experiment that we have, that humans have done on two species. And what we've discovered, obviously, through these breeding of dogs and horses, that when you take a standard wolf, you know, and breed it to the size of a Great Dane, its life expectancy goes down, and its ailments goes really bad. We've taken a standard horse and bred it to a draft horse that's, you know, twice the size of a regular horse and a lot more bigger. And those draft horses have a shorter life expectancy, and their health is just terrible. A number of draft horses, when they're born, their skin just literally falls off their body. I know people are aware of that. And so we've already proven, mankind has already proven, in my opinion, in real-time experiments, that natural selection and mutations do not work. In my sense, obviously, from those two experiments, a whale's life expectancy should be just, you know, a couple of years, and yet baleen whales are one of the oldest animals here. I think we found baleen whales with bone spears in them that are over 200 years old. So the baleen whales are one of the longest living mammals on this planet, and yet our real-time experiments with dogs and horses prove that that just shouldn't be. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's been done all across the the life of species. Now, the reason why you see all these different species of horses over the past 50 million years has seen it be progressing from small to big, and the whales from small to big. Horses and whales, because of their big body size, small population levels, and long generation times, they go extinct rapidly. And so just as, you know, the smaller the body size, the bigger the population, the shorter the generation time, the higher the probability for evolutionary change. Also, the higher the probability they're going to stick around for a while. But the opposite is true. The bigger the body size, the fewer the progeny per adult, and the longer the generation time, the faster they go extinct. God likes whales. So when one goes extinct, he makes a new one. And he's been doing that progressively. God likes horses. So when a horse species go extinct, he makes a new one, but he also makes the new ones in a way to benefit the rest of life on planet Earth. So the whales, we see that he creates them in such a way as to balance the temperature of the surface of the Earth. And the example of horses and dogs that you've been giving, Dave, basically is showing the limits of how far we can push natural selection and mutations to get these different dogs. And so we've made dogs so tiny they can fit in your hand. We make them so big, they're half the size of a horse. But as you pointed out, when you look at a Great Dane, they don't live very long, and they don't live at all unless they're in the home of human beings that are taking very good care of them. Same thing with these teacup poodles. If you leave them on the floor, they're vibrating all the time. But they need a lot of human care. So the farther you push natural selection and mutations to get the creatures you want, the less survivable the creatures are. And so if you want a healthy dog that's going to live a long time, try to keep it like a fox or a wolf, like a coyote, because the more you try to evolve it away from there, the less the probability. But the fact is, we human beings, because we invest a lot of time and effort, can actually keep these animals alive where they'd never be alive in the real world. Now, the most famous evolution experiment done is at Michigan State University, and it's called the Long-Term Evolution Experiment. Now, what's interesting about that long-term evolution experiment, they figured out just what I told you, is that the smaller the body size, the higher probability of getting some evolutionary change. The larger the population, the higher the probability, the faster the reproduction time. And so they quickly figured out, well, bacteria are at the top of the heap. No animal, no life species evolves more efficiently than a bacteria. And the best known bacterium out there is E. coli bacteria. So they said, we're going to do experiments on E. coli bacteria. And what they notice about E. coli bacteria, they have the biochemical machinery to be able to draw energy from sugar, basically sucrose, and also from, I'm trying to remember the name, caltrate. And so they said, what we're going to do, we're going to have 12 different large populations of E. coli bacteria. And what we're going to do is we're going to put all 12 populations on a starvation diet of sucrose. And we're going to blast them with all the caltrate they can imagine. And we're going to see if the E. coli will evolve from preferring the sucrose to actually metabolizing, I'm not pronouncing it right, C-A-L-C-A-R-A-T. And it took 20 years before one of the 12 populations actually was able to survive, not on sugar, but on the substitute. And none of the other 11 did. The experiment has now been running for 40 years. They still have just one population that's done it. And what they were testing was, what we see in the history of life on planet Earth, evolution repeats all the time. We see hundreds of examples of unrelated species having the identical anatomical features and the identical behavior. Probably the most famous example being the chameleon and the sand lance. The chameleon is a desert reptile, and it's got this spring-loaded tongue, and it's got eyes that can move independent of one another, and because the eyes move independent of one another, it can very accurately track the motion of bugs through the air, and basically it does that tracking. It's got this spring-loaded tongue that zips out and grabs the insect. The sand lance is a fish that exists on the bottom of the seafloor and basically just buries itself in the muck at the bottom of the sea and waits for a fish to go by. But likewise, it's got eyes that move independent of one another, a spring-loaded tongue, and it's also got protection over the eye that's identical to that of the chameleon. Identical designs in creatures that are completely unrelated to one another from an evolutionary perspective. And we see hundreds of examples of this. So what they tried to do in the long-term evolution experiment, does this happen naturalistically? And the answer is, it doesn't. We can't get evolution to repeat. We did see it happen once, and the remarkable thing is, they would allow these E. coli bacteria to go through 500 generations, and then at 500 generations, they would grab a sample and put it in cold storage, basically suspended animation. And so it took 25,000 generations before they saw the change from feeding on sucrose to feeding on that caltrate. And then they said, let's go back and pull back 1,000 generations and see if we can make it happen again. When they went back 500 and let it evolve, sometimes it would repeat, but when they went back more than 5,000 generations, it never repeated. And so it's basically saying, we can't explain why we see these hundreds, and it's actually thousands of examples of repeated evolutionary outcome. The experiment is still running. And as people have pointed out, you would never get that change from feeding on sucrose to feeding on this different energy source unless you had human biologists forcing that outcome. It would never happen in the natural world because the sugars would always be more plentiful. But by forcing it in the lab, they can get the change. But even when you're forcing it in the lab to make the change that you desire, only one population out of 12 so far has done it. experiment's still running, and maybe after 60, 80 years, you'll get a second population, but already the results are clear. It doesn't explain what we see in the record of nature.
Craig McMahon asks, Dr. Becky Smethurst at Oxford presented a video claiming that the perchlorate problem with Martian soil could easily be remedied for growing potatoes on Mars. Do you agree with this?
Well, yeah. If you get humans on Mars that basically terra-transform the soil, you can make it work. And so what she's talking about is we could, you know, basically breed potatoes to be more tolerant of those perchlorates, and at the same time rework the Martian soil to try to leach the perchlorates out. And if we do both, maybe we've got a chance of growing potatoes on Martian soil. However, it ignores the sulfur problem. Yes, the Martian soil is way too abundant in perchlorates to grow any crops on Mars. But it's also got way too much sulfur to grow any crops on Mars. And those are just two of multiple examples. So there's multiple problems with Martian soil. The sulfur problem, Martian soil has got 60 times as much sulfur as Earth soil. So yes, you got the same problem. You'd have to basically take equipment to Mars and get that sulfur out of the soil before you can grow anything. And also you could go with crops and say, can we make crops more sulfur tolerant? And what she's claiming is, if we do both, maybe we can come up with a happy medium where we get something. But it's not just perchlorate, it's not just sulfur. There's multiple chemical problems with Martian soil. Your best bet, and it's a whole lot cheaper, bring Earth's soil to Mars and make sure it doesn't touch any Martian soil and grow your crops there.
Thank you, Dr. Ross. I have two questions, but I'm only going to ask one. You were talking about whales, and I thought about Jonah and that whole story, but I'm not going to ask about that. I'm going to ask one of the more stupid questions that I've asked probably, but I keep hearing people say that if we evolved from, I'm going to really simplify it, okay? If we evolved from apes, how come we still have apes? And they, you know, a lot of the atheists, when I see somebody make that argument, they laugh at the people that say that, and they even have memes mocking people that say that. And I'm just wondering how you think we should respond, if at all, in that regard. I mean, I think there's a lot of non-scientists that wonder about that.
Well, the reason why you get that reaction is because that's not what evolutionary biologists believe. They don't believe we evolved from the apes. They believe that the apes and humans evolved from a common ancestor. So like 30, 50 million years ago, there was this creature that produced different lineages, one of which produced the modern day apes, the others that produced the hominid species, and that were evolved from those hominids and also a common ancestor with the chimpanzees. That's their model. But again, you're dealing with creatures that are really big with small populations. So you got the same problem that you got with the whales. How do you explain what we see in the fossil record? The fossil record is real. I mean, we do see all these different species that trace back in time, and we see a progression towards diversity and complexity. But when you actually look at the apes and you look at humans and you look at Neanderthals, their populations, their generation times, it's easy to recognize you got the same problem with the whales. They're not going to evolve at the rapid rate that's claimed in the scientific literature. They're going to go extinct. And so the reason why you see all these different fossils of different species is these creatures are going extinct rapidly and they're being replaced by the creator. And we're gonna actually get to a point in the series where we talk about the differences between Neanderthals and humans. Because the claim is Neanderthals and humans evolved from a common ancestor just a few million years ago. Well, if that's the case, how do you explain the gross differences between humans and Neanderthals. And this is a major change. 50 years ago, the scientific literature was basically claiming Neanderthals are anatomically identical to us human beings. That's no longer the case. There's a recognition that their anatomical differences are huge. And the biggest differences are in the heads of the Neanderthals compared to the heads of the humans, and the brains of Neanderthals compared to the brains of humans. But you got anatomical differences all the way down to the feet. But we'll get to that later.
Thank you, Hugh. Slam RN wants to know, do you think Adam and Eve had pets?
I think Adam and Eve had pets because, after all, you see in Genesis chapter 2, God basically gave Adam an order saying, hey, go check out all these nephesh creatures out there, all these bird and mammal species that I created to relate to you and serve and please you. And he was without sin, and so these animals basically were approaching him, wanting to relate to him and serve and please him. And in that sense, I think, yes. But what he discovered is they make great pets, but they don't really fulfill all my relational needs. And that's when God said, well, I'm going to create a creature that does. That's body, soul, and spirit, just like you are, because these animals that he was naming and relating to were not spirit creatures. And so it was a limitation in the degree to which they could relate to him. But yeah. In fact, on the 16th, when I give the talk on animals, I'm basically going to show some examples. And, you know, Dave, yeah, you've given some talks here in the class. What happens when these animals relate to humans where sin is not a factor? Instead of running away from us, they come towards us. And they really do have a strong desire to relate to a higher species, just like God has given us a strong desire to relate to a higher being.
Hi, Dr. Ross. So I was diagnosed with delusional schizophrenia in 2017, and I haven't experienced symptoms for many years thanks to the tools God's given me. And I'm very open about my illness, otherwise I wouldn't, you know. But I know that within theology, demons can not only exacerbate illnesses, they can also cause them. And rest assured, I won't be offended or perturbed if you would say there is an interplay between the spiritual and whatever you may know about schizophrenia. And for those of you who may be wondering, schizophrenia is not the same as what's called dissociative identity disorder. People with DID experience, you know, what's called multiple personalities, and that's not what I experienced. In my experience, I thought I was a prophet. You know, the nurses struggled not to laugh while I was in the hospital, but technically that makes me a former false prophet, which is fun. So yeah, I'm wondering what your perspectives are, if any, on the interplay between the spiritual realms and schizophrenia. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. And if you were to go back several centuries in the history of the church, when people saw schizophrenia being manifested in a way that was disturbing to other people, they'd often say, demon possessed. Now that we know more about schizophrenia, we realize from a Christian perspective that certain brain disorders we're dealing with can make an individual more susceptible to being attacked by demons, but it doesn't mean you will be. And so what's happened in the Christian medical literature today, there's no longer this branding of everybody that has schizophrenia as being oppressed or possessed by demons. We realize it could happen. It's more likely to happen, but you can live your whole life as a schizophrenic where that never happens at all. And therefore, we're now using a very different approach to people with schizophrenia than was the case 400 years ago. And, my younger son has a doctoral degree in brain disorders, and so he deals with people who have schizophrenia, but he also deals with people who've got dementia. He deals with people who've got ADHD. He deals with people that are autistic. There's all kinds of these different brain disorders. Well, what's interesting about all these brain disorders is that there are issues that these people struggle with, but there's also things that they can do that normal people can't do. And what's interesting, at least in the studies I've done, is that the percentages of people with what we call these brain disorders actually is at an optimal level for the human population. We need a few people with ADHD. We need a few people with bipolar disorders because they can do things normal humans can't do. But we also need to make sure these people are being integrated with people that are called neurotypical, people who don't have these kinds. And by the way, my son's comment is, there's no human being that's neurotypical. We all got some kind of brain disorder or abnormality, but we need to be socially integrated in a way that we're helping one another with the problems that come with these issues, but also benefiting from what they can contribute. And so isolating them is a bad thing. And that's what's happening, again, even decades ago, where they would take people with ADHD and put them in a special classroom. We're now realizing it's much better not to do that because neurotypical people don't benefit from what they can contribute, and they also can't help people with the issues that go on with ADHD. So that's a quick answer, and I'm glad I got this son that gives me all these examples of, and his whole point is diagnosing people to find out what's wrong with them, then making sure they get the appropriate therapy. But he says the best therapy is make sure they're well integrated with people that are neurotypical or people that got different disorders, and also ensure that they're humble enough to benefit from the help that they receive. I myself am on the autistic spectrum. And so what I've learned is putting a bunch of autistic people together, like what happens at Caltech, is not a good thing. They have some rather extreme social disorders there. And what you see on the Big Bang TV show, actually, they have toned it down a lot. It's way worse than what you see in the Big Bang TV series. So we need to be integrated, and that's a biblical principle. We're to help one another. And as Paul has explained, we all have deficiencies, and God's glory wants to shine through our deficiencies. But that won't happen if we're not well integrated with one another and humbly helping one another. Okay.
Hugh, as almost always, we're out of time, and there's still plenty of good questions online. So I just want to say to all the people online, ask your question again next week and ask it soon so I can get to it. And I just want to say a thank you to Aleo for being that honest and humble to be able to talk about that in front of the world. So thank you. Hugh, would you please close us in prayer?
Yeah, I'll just share one little thing. We had one employee that had bipolar disorder. And the thing about bipolar disorder is that they can focus for 12 hours and get an incredible amount of work done. And it's easy to take advantage of that. But if they do way too much work too fast, they have a crash event, which can be quite unpleasant for them and people around them. So what we had to learn is, hey, we got to prevent that person from being too focused on the work and basically burning herself out on the work. And so, we all need to know what we're dealing with here. Father in heaven, we want to thank you that you've blessed each one of us with incredible gifts, and thank you too for blessing each one of us with deficiencies. Lord, we need one another. We need to help one another. And Father, we want to be humble enough to allow your Holy Spirit to shine through both our gifts and our deficiencies, that people will realize it's not us, it's you that's basically being manifested. So Father, help us to be humble before you so that your glory can shine with us to a world where they can receive what you're offering. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.